The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On today's show, coming up in the second segment, we'll be looking more at the purpose of God's church. You heard a segment from our Belfast pack on Sunday, and we'll continue on with some of the same material in Mystery of the Ages. Chapter 6 of Mystery of the Ages, that's coming up later on in the show. Well, an almost unbelievable article in the Spectator today, at least one that 20 or 30 years ago would have been a stunning revelation, an article about the 105th Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. He was elected in 2013. He comes from the radical left wing. He's very much anti-Brexit. He's all about raising taxes and adding more social programs and such. But this article at the Spectator, it brings out this lovely and endearing relationship that he has with the Catholic Church, with Catholic cardinals, and even the Pope. But what it says even at the start, there's lots of takeaways from this piece, by the way, but it says that he's dealing with a national church whose Sunday services are now attended by barely 1% of England's population. And the article says these are new times and require new tactics. Isn't that the truth? We're living in secular Britain, and it's not as bad in the United States. Of course, we're not talking about true religion here in either case. But just the drift away from religion, just the drift away from anything having to do with the Bible. We're living in new times, 1% of England's population. I mentioned the United States. There's this piece at the Daily Mail about the rise of Satanism in America. The rise of Satanism and these movements. This one in particular, they call it the Satanic Temple, founded in 2012, just with a handful of members, only 7 years ago, and now there's tens of thousands of members, worldwide even. They've got congregations all over the globe, Stockholm, London, Los Angeles, Texas. It's only been around for a few years, started with a handful. And now there's tens of thousands. The rise of Satanism in America. No wonder. No wonder we're morally sick. No wonder there's so much political dysfunction in our nations. No wonder we can't agree on anything. It doesn't work out, to use Britain as a case in point. It doesn't work out when we're in the EU. And then we try to get out and it won't work. What's driving the chaos? That's what Daniel Hannan asked today at a conservative home, talking about Brexit and why it's proving to be so difficult. He quotes the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michael Barnier, who supposedly said a couple of years ago that I'll have done my job if in the end the deal is so tough on the British that they'd prefer to stay in the EU. He said that to a French publication. The EU wanted to make it so tough on Britain that in the end they'd prefer to stay. And you look at quite a few. All of Parliament, as we've stressed before, it's just the people. I played that clip the other day from Question Time. Well, what if we just have to make a clean break with no deal? And the audience erupted in applause. That okay, that's what we voted for. We voted to leave. But all of these leaders, the intelligentsia, they don't want that. They don't want it. And here's the EU trying to make it as difficult on Britain as possible. They're trying to punish Britain. And the British leaders, they just go right along. There's another article at the Spectator today about how Germany has helped to shape the conditions for Brexit. Imagine that. Germany. It goes through some fairly recent history. How that Germany threw Greece to the wolves back in 2008 refers to Germany using economic waterboarding, torture, torturing Greece to get its own way. This is the way it is. Everyone knows where the real power is in Europe, in this supposed union of equals. Spectator says, when the EU talks of the four freedoms, people, capital, goods, and services, being sacrosanct, it is worth noting that Germany chooses not to play by the rules when it suits, to the particular disadvantage of the UK with its strengths in services and capital. They're all about holding up rules and standards, but not so careful about applying them to themselves. If it doesn't suit their desires, their ambitions, their aims, they just disregard it. Switching back to this Daniel Hannan piece, he says, Brussels negotiators have made a series of demands that they know to be outrageous and that they know and that they would never dream of making on any other country. He says the normal British reaction to such blackmail would be to bridle at the threat and dig in defense of democracy. He says in a healthy polity, even those who had voted Remain would be appalled by the bullying tone and would rally around a policy that honored the referendum result. Even the Remainers, in just looking at what the EU is doing, looking at the bullying tactics. There was a time not so long ago when the British leadership, the British parliamentarians would be roused from sleep, angered by what was going on. Back when, as he says, the polity was healthier. But, as he brings out, our polity is far from healthy at present. There's a sickness. There's a sickness. I've mentioned that Melanie Phillips piece a couple times this week where she talks about Britain's special history as it compares to all of the fighting and the constantly moving boundaries of nations in Europe, the mainland. And here, the little British island, she pointed out how that it hasn't been invaded in 1,000 years. Britain's special history, she said, has created its national character, independent of mind, stoic under pressure, opposed to extremism, but ferocious in defense of its liberties, and very, very averse to being bullied or told what to do. Back when it was healthy, the politics in Britain, they were averse to being bullied by Europe, by the mainland. But see, today, as she concludes in her article, there's this intelligentsia that's determined to bring down the nation, to distort the nation's history, to exaggerate its failings. There's a sickness. Hosea 5 and verse 13 speaks of Ephraim seeing his sickness. I mentioned Isaiah 1 the other day about the sickness in Israel from head to toe. All these wounds and bruises, putrefying sores, it says in Isaiah 1. Sores that they have not been able to close up. Sores that they're not able to mollify with ointment. Every direction that you look, sickness. Spectator had another piece today about the scent. The scent in London smells like marijuana in the city. It's everywhere. this author says. And it shows just how much the city has changed. He said 10 years ago, when he'd cycle through London, the dominant scent was diesel. And then you'd get some wafts of tobacco mixed in. Maybe coffee, the aroma of coffee. But today, those scents have faded. And now you have this smell of cannabis everywhere that you go. It says, why does this city smell differently? I found a bit of research from the University of York, which might provide part of an answer. They looked last year at the number of people accessing drug treatment services over the past 10 years and found not a rise in overall users, but a dramatic rise in the number of people over 40 smoking cannabis. Nearly 120% adults. They're just on their way to work now, smoking weed, smoking marijuana. And this article points out what should be obvious. It was 10, 15 years ago that people who indulge in that sort of thing, they're more likely to be violent. It's going to be a lot harder for them to hold a family together or to have a stable job, a stable occupation. This is what we want. We want it in the UK. We want it in the United States. And you have these regions in and around Seattle or San Francisco. They're leading the way with this kind of nonsense, with this kind of depravity. And look at what's happening to America's big cities. Look at London. The United States, speaking of depravity, we've reached a new level or a new low in depravity with respect to abortion. This week, the New York State Senate, it passed legislation that basically allows for abortion all the way up through to the birth, all the way up through 40 weeks, if you can believe it. Now, Andrew Cuomo, he's the Democratic governor, the radical leftist governor. He's been wanting more expansive abortion rights legislation, and he's gotten it, and he's about to sign it. It says the legislation provides a further exception to permit abortion at any point during pregnancy if, here's the big if a healthcare practitioner deems it necessary for the mother's life or health, and they don't really define what it means, if it's necessary for the mother's health, then the abortion practitioner can say, well, yes, let's go ahead and abort it at 39 and a half weeks. National Review says, in other words, abortion will be available to women essentially on demand up to the point of birth. The bill will also decriminalize abortion, moving it from the state's criminal code to the public health code. So now it's up to public health officials in New York City. They can decide if it's, it's needed because of her health, you see. You look at how the language is worded, as I said, and there's no real defining of the word health. Did you know in New York City that there's 544 abortions for every 1,000 live births? This is according to the CDC. 1,000 births and 544 abortions. In other words, one in three babies in New York City are aborted. They're murdered before they even have a chance. They're murdered in the womb. And now it can happen as late as the birth, almost. New York City's abortion rate makes up more than half the city's birth rate. 2015 figures. This is New York City alone. In 2015, 63,646 abortions in just 1 year. And as we know, of course, this is not a medical procedure. It's the deliberate, systematic slaughter of future God beings. A new low in depravity. Government-sanctioned infanticide. Last week, they had the March for Life in Washington, D.C. And this Abby Johnson, she spoke at the event, and she's pretty outspoken with respect to being pro-life. She was interviewed by Breitbart and had this to say on a radio show. I forget the name of the program, but anyway, to give you some of the background, she used to be an abortion clinic director at Planned Parenthood until all of that changed one day. And here's what she said, clip one.
I worked for Planned Parenthood for 8 years. I was a clinic director there, like you said. I left in 2009 after a couple things. One, I was told that my job was to double the amount of abortion, so double our abortion quota that we had in our clinic, which was troubling to me because I have been told now for all of these years that our goal was to reduce the number of abortions, but here I am being told to double our quota. Then about a month later, I was asked to help participate in an ultrasound-guided abortion procedure. Ultrasounds are generally not used during the actual abortion procedure itself. But we had a new physician in our clinic that day, and he wanted to show us what this looked like and thought it would be a good learning opportunity for us. And I watched as a 13-week-old fetus fought and struggled for his life against the abortion instrument. And I knew then that there was humanity in the womb and that abortion was taking the life of this innocent human being. And I decided to leave Planned Parenthood.
Yet another report from yet another insider. You can see why they don't show ultrasounds typically. They don't show these gals coming in for their abortions, seeking counsel, seeking guidance from the health professionals, the healthcare practitioners. Don't show them an ultrasound. Don't show them life. A 13-week-old, a little fetus fighting and struggling for its life against this abortion instrument. And there's various ways that they go about killing it. Disgusting ways. But they were being pushed. We need to have more abortions. The bottom line, we've got to make more money doing this. And they're out there, when they're talking about that industry, they're out there saying, oh, we discourage it. Just like she said, well, I thought we were supposed to discourage it. I thought this was like a last resort type thing. Oh, no, 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 this is an insider. This is promoted. This is encouraged. And now you can do it all the way up to the birth in New York. That's what Andrew Cuomo wanted. More expansive abortion rights. God said in the last days we'd be even without natural affection. And you certainly see that prophecy being fulfilled in this genocidal culture of snuffing out millions of lives in the womb. Mr. Armstrong, this was right around Roe v. Wade. He came out in the plain truth straight away to address this. Is abortion murder, he asked? Well, what is murder? It's the ending of a human life prior to the end of its natural lifetime. To deliberately end that life 1 or 2 months after it started, conception, is putting an end to a life, a human life, as much as it is to do it 10 or 11 months after, or 50 years after. It says the sixth commandment of God denies others the right to take an innocent life and under divine law, guarantees the innocent the right to continue living. But we disregard that law in this morally depraved era that we're in. A new low. You know, those Covington boys, they were coming back from this right to life march. You can see why the media attacked them after seeing a 4-minute video. You can see why the media, they didn't want to wait around for the 90-minute or 2-hour video to actually look at the evidence. They weren't concerned about the truth. These boys fit the profile. Pro-life. Pro-Trump. They were white. They were from Kentucky. And so they're an open target, pure and simple. It's about, just like Tucker Carlson said last night, it's about attacking them for who they are. Here's what he said, clip 3.
This is not an argument about facts and evidence and truth. It's an argument about identity. The Kentucky students are being attacked for who they are, not for what they did or didn't do.
It's who they are that the intelligentsia hates. Like the Wall Street Journal headline said yesterday, these are the high school deplorables, the way the radical left views it. They are irredeemable. They are deplorable. They are the object of much scorn. They deserve it. Victor Davis Hanson, I haven't had time to get to this yet, but he had a piece a couple weeks ago about a license to hate. And he talked about all of these commentators and these celebrities and even politicians when they comment about Donald Trump's supporters. People at a Trump rally, for instance, one commentator said, if you put everyone's mouths together in this video, you'd get one full set of teeth. So they're toothless. They're garbage people, others have said. They're uneducated. They're lazy. They smell. They're like apes. Mr. Trump's compared to Hitler. His supporters are compared to Nazis or the KKK or termites. Former Vice President Biden, he said that Trump supporters are virulent people, the dregs of society. We know they're virulent. We know they're angry. A New York Times reporter says, oh man, it's kind of sick how much joy I get out of being cruel to old white men. And she writes for the New York Times. She loves being cruel when it comes to political opponents. And of course, it was Hillary Clinton who made the comment about the deplorables, the irredeemables. Hanson says, note the force of such dehumanizing invective that transcends political differences. Trump voters were not just mistaken in their political allegiances. Instead, they looked like toothless zombies and stunk up stores. They're not quite human. They're destined to die off. And all of this is coming from the supposedly progressive humanists. It's coming supposedly from the tolerant. He says in his conclusion, Victor Davis Hanson, finally, we're learning that the entire idea of political correctness was never much about universal ideas of tolerance of the other or insistence that language and protocols must not stigmatize individuals by lumping them into stereotyped and dehumanized collective groups. What we're witnessing instead is that it is fine. It is fine to demonize millions, from their appearance to their purported hygiene and smell to affinities with feces and apes, if it serves political or cultural agendas. In sum, cultural progressivism is about raw power, not principle. That's what it is. It's what my father has said before. It's all about bringing down the system. It's all about inciting revolution. It's all about grabbing hold of power. And so the young white Catholic boys, they show up. Wait, they're waiting for a bus. And they're just absolutely ridiculed. Verbally abused. The black Israelite group. Then here comes the Indian activists. And of course, all of the people on social media that hop on the bandwagon and say, this 16-year-old boy, he deserves to be punched in the face. That Catholic school, that's a hate factory. Dox them all. Reveal their personal information. Reveal their addresses online so that we can harass them. So that we can go after them. And then you have the media for their part. They're putting out all of this misleading information, all of these lies, trashing the students. Well, last year when they were anti-gun activists, those students were practically worshipped. They were just brought on to CNN set and given the full hour almost. But not these boys. Even when the truth came out, a few, like I said yesterday, a few apologized for jumping to conclusions. But you look at what's happened since, and they're still being attacked. They're still being attacked. And this Native American, we're finding out more and more about him. The media just appalled, saying that the boys confronted him, and he's a Vietnam vet. And he's not even a Vietnam vet, we now know. And of course it was the other way around. He's the one that walked over to the boys. The Wall Street Journal editorial staff, it said some of the students did respond to Mr. Phillips by doing the tomahawk chop, and it would have been better had they all walked away. But on the whole, these teenagers were calm amid the provocations and far less incendiary than the adults who taunted them and the progressive high priest who denounced them. In other words, the youths, in this case, they were more adult-like than the adults. And yet you look, like I said yesterday, you look at the way the youths are treated and the way that 16-year-old boy was interviewed. Well, don't you have something to apologize for? Shouldn't you have not worn that MAGA hat? And on and on and on it goes. The journal concludes here saying most of those who so eagerly maligned these boys will face no lasting consequences, while the boys themselves will always have to wonder when they're turned down for a job or a school whether someone had Googled their name and found only half this story. This is an ugly moment in America, all right. But there are few things uglier than a righteous leftist mob. A self-righteous leftist mob. It's getting ugly. It's getting ugly. The president said yesterday about the Democrats, about how they've been radicalized. He's talking about this dispute with Nancy Pelosi in the State of the Union address. But listen to what the president had to say. Clip 2.
It's really a shame what's happening with the Democrats. They've become radicalized. They don't want to see crime stop, which we can very easily do on the southern border. And it really is a shame what's happening with the Democrats. This will go on for a while. Ultimately, the American people will have their way because they want to see no crime. They want to see what we're doing.
He's about the only one who stands up to them, and that's why they hate him. That's why they want to destroy him. That's why they'll produce false information, create false narratives, so that they can, as Joy Behar said earlier this week, so that they can destroy them. That's their goal. That's their objective. It really is getting ugly, and it's leading to all-out war, civil war, destruction from within. To just conclude that thought Tucker Carlson had last night, he speaks of this as more dangerous than an actual foreign invasion. Here's what he said, clip 4.
When people start thinking that, the whole project falls apart. People start hating each other, and not hating each other for their opinions. We could fix that. People's views evolve over time. Political divisions can heal and often do. But fights over identity do not. They are different. Identity does not change. It cannot be moderated or controlled. It's inherent. We're born that way. When we go to war over who we are, it is a permanent battle. It is a disaster that lasts for generations. Identity politics will destroy this country faster than a foreign invasion.
And the prophecies, of course, say that it's going to be both. Isaiah, or rather Ezekiel 4 and 5. And then you add to that the many prophecies regarding the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, Britain and America's traditional enemy, coming out of the heart of Europe. Well, as I say, there's quite a few takeaways from that that Justin Welby piece at The Spectator. You think about another prophecy that this really reveals, this story, as I said, it speaks about just how close he is to the Vatican and to Catholic cardinals. The article says 10 years ago, the Vatican made it easier for vicars to defect to Rome. Hundreds did so, and now, by some estimates, 1 in 10 Catholic priests is a former Anglican vicar. They're moving over to the Catholic Church, to the Mother Church. You think of that prophecy in Isaiah 47. You think about what my father has said, what Herbert Armstrong said decades ago. This was prophesied. And Justin Welby, he thinks it's great. This article says, what we need is for people to be disciples. This is quoting Welby. What we need is for people to be disciples of Jesus Christ. I don't really care whether it's the Church of England or Rome or the Orthodox or Pentecostals or the Lutherans or Baptists. They are faithful disciples of Christ. See, this is where we are. Let's just all come underneath the Catholic umbrella once again. This is the way it was historically. And this Spectator piece says how these comments from the Archbishop of Canterbury, they really would have come as a shock to people in Britain just a few years ago. 5, 10, maybe 15 years ago? Notice the conclusion. It says Cardinal Nichols and I would describe each other as very close friends. This is, again, quoting Welby. We see each other regularly. We pray together. We talk together. You know, 50 years ago, that would have been news. Spectator says, and he has Catholic friends in even higher places. I go and see the Pope quite regularly. We talk about personal things, about what it is to be a follower of Jesus Christ in today's world. I ask him questions, and he's very helpful. You have to wonder if this prophecy in Isaiah 47, if it's already been fulfilled. Mr. Armstrong, in a clip from 1982, he said here how that the Bible prophesized that Rome would try to get the daughters back, and he didn't know just how close that union would be. But listen to what he says in a sermon from 1982, clip 6.
And now, Mother Rome is trying to get her daughters back, and the Pope signed up some kind of an agreement with the head of the Church of England just a couple of 3 weeks ago in London. And they're getting back together. I don't know how far they'll get back together, but it's starting in that direction. And things are starting until there will be 10 nations in Europe that will form one great empire, and that's going to happen. And old Mother Rome is going to ride on top of the heap, and then the mark of the beast is going to be enforced.
These prophecies are being fulfilled. Regarding that that prophecy in Isaiah 47, my father wrote back in 2007 that this prophecy It speaks of the Catholic Church and that it would experience a great rebellion against her evil deeds. There would be this great rebellion or breakaway, this protest. And that happened centuries ago. And then, my father wrote, and then in the very end time, these daughters would be brought back under her direction. She would not know the loss of children. That's language from Isaiah 47. We're certainly, what did it say at the beginning of that article? We're certain there's lots of takeaways, as I said, but we're certainly living in new times. That's for sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
One of our listeners was reading through Mystery of the Ages yet again, as he emailed me to say, another study through this literary masterpiece by Herbert Armstrong. And as he was going through the early pages of that book and the author's statement and also the preface, he overheard yesterday's broadcast, the tail end of it, where I talked about truth and the lack thereof in these last days. And I mentioned the example of Mr. Armstrong and how that he had a hunger for truth. And this listener was saying just how much the comments that I made there at the end of the show really did harmonize with what he was reading and studying in Mystery of the Ages. He says, "The reason I write is to thank you and the team for sticking to the trunk of the tree and keeping us focused on what is supremely important. Right out of the gate, Mr. Armstrong began Mystery of the Ages by discussing modern science and education's attempt to explain the creation without a creator. What do we have to show for it today? The enlightened boys and girls coming out of the universities have nothing to stand on. Instead, what is under them shifts and quakes and tilts with the whims and unsubstantiated notions of men. How unpredictably frightening," he says. Instead, Mr. Armstrong was compelled to understand. He was compelled to understand. What a difference! I thought of that simple but profound word. If we're going to stand, there must be something under that. There must be something under that that ensures solid footing and balance, a sure foundation. Well, that spiritual foundation is actually called that in Isaiah 28. A sure foundation, a precious cornerstone. That's what Jesus Christ is to this church. And that's why you have stability and strength and unity in the church of God. He writes, your closing comments aligned perfectly with the end of Mystery's preface, as Mr. Armstrong quoted from the 111th Psalm, a good understanding have all they that do his commandments. That precious book, Mystery of the Ages, was written nearly 35 years ago, and in the beginning pages, Mr. Armstrong writes, time may prove this to be the most important book written in almost 1900 years. That's how important it is. That book, written in 1985, as I said in Belfast, was the truth. And if it was true in 1985, it's true today. It's still true. After all these years, it's the same with the Bible. The Bible's much older. Mr. Armstrong said, look, Mystery of the Ages is not on the level of the Bible, but I do believe God inspired it. God inspired me. God inspired the writing that went into that book. It is a literary masterpiece. This listener writes, Mr. Armstrong credited not its literary excellence or flowery language of scholarship, but instead its plainness of speech. He said it clarifies the most important knowledge ever revealed from the supreme source of understanding. It says, finally, thank you and the Trumpet team for faithfully and fearlessly following Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, a man who understood the importance of that book and fought courageously in court to distribute it, to freely distribute it. Ultimately, thanks to the supreme source of understanding who used Mr. Armstrong to decode the Bible and pen Mystery of the Ages, the most important book in almost 1900 years, indeed. He says, finally, we need your broadcast to keep us oriented. We need you to navigate us through the sea storm of confusion and misinformation. Yes, indeed, we need a sure foundation. God built his church on a sure foundation that doesn't shake. It's not tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. It's solid. It's immovable. And that's because you have Jesus Christ. Like Isaiah 28:16 says, you have Jesus Christ as the precious cornerstone, a tried stone, a foundation of stone. Yes, a sure foundation. And to have your mind opened to that truth, coming from that head, coming from that precious stone. Well, that is a glorious and matchless privilege and honor to have our minds opened to the truth, as the last part of that segment on Monday brought out, John 6:44 and 45. No man can come to me, Jesus said, unless the Father calls him, unless the Father opens his mind. God has to perform a miracle. Jesus in Matthew 13, when his disciples asked him why he spoke in parables, he said, because it's given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. Think about that. Here he had just 12 disciples, and he went around speaking to the masses, but he spoke in parables. Why? Many assume it's, well, to make it plain, to make it understandable. He said, Jesus said, and this is why people don't know the Bible, or it's certainly one proof of that fact. Jesus said he spoke in parables because they didn't understand, and it wasn't given to them to understand at that time. So he'd speak in parables to the masses, and then he'd go away and he'd explain the meaning to the disciples, just a handful of disciples. And the reason there were just a few is because that's how God started. It was first, the first objective was to teach and to train disciples or students so that they could then go and teach and train others. Quite unlike what is represented in the world of traditional Christianity, which teaches that there's this great contest going on. And you can see this, too, in the opening pages of Mystery of the Ages. This false doctrine, this is what really impelled Mr. Armstrong to put together the material for Mystery of the Ages. The fact that the whole world, the traditional Christian world, believes that there's a great contest going on between God and the devil. But in this great contest, if that's the truth, Satan clearly is winning. Look at this depraved world that we're in. 1%. 1% of the English. 1% in England attend church services. If there is a great contest, Satan clearly is winning. Mr. Armstrong wrote in Mystery, "For some years I had come to partially realize the error of this assumption, the assumption that there's this contest going on, but the full truth on this point had not come crystal clear to me until very recently. The truth is indeed mind-boggling. It clears what had been clouded in mystery. To the world, you see, it's a mystery. It's a great mystery. But if our minds are open to the truth, we understand and realize the significance of Genesis 3, 22 through 24. And the fact that God closed the Holy Spirit and eternal life off to mankind in general until the removal of Satan from the throne of this earth and the return of his Son, Jesus Christ, to set up the kingdom of God on earth. Until that happens, it would just be the few called out in advance to be trained to assist Jesus Christ in ruling the world. God needs a government administration. It's not a one-man show. It's Jesus Christ and his bride. It's family. There is no contest between God and the devil. The devil is where he is because God has allowed it, and his time is about up, as Revelation 12 says. He knows he has but a short time. He's the reason. You look at this world in all of its depravity. He's the reason. He's the cause. And all these prophecies being fulfilled. Meanwhile, the church, it's fulfilling God's will. It's carrying out God's will to this earth. Warning the world. Preaching the gospel to all the world, prophesying again, Matthew 24, 14, and Revelation 10 and verse 11. Warning of the sword emerging in Europe, Ezekiel 33. And making disciples, as it says in Matthew 28 and verse 19. Go you, therefore, this is Christ's admonition to the disciples, go you, therefore, and teach all nations, or the meaning there is to make disciples of all nations. You can see that in the Revised Standard Version. Go you, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. That's not a soul-saving crusade. You have to put that together with John 6:44. No man can come to Christ except the Father which has sent Christ draws him. But we have a job in carrying out this work of making disciples, that when God calls them, we in the church, we're ready to work with them, to teach them, to work with the lambs and the sheep, as it says in John 21. To feed the sheep, to feed the lambs. Jesus Christ was a great educator, a teacher. Nicodemus said as much when he encountered him in John 3. Master, he said to him. He was the schoolmaster. And we, as disciples, we're in the position of students. We're the learners. The church, established by Jesus Christ, is like a school. Jesus himself, the original schoolmaster or teacher, the original 12 disciples or students that worked along with Jesus Christ for 3.5 years, he was educating them, he was teaching them, he was training them to become teachers themselves. Verse 20 of Matthew 28, it says, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. And so we're called out of this world, for one, to become teachers. We're in training. We're training to teach the whole world. But there's a second, equally important reason that we're called out now, especially in this end time. It's because we're needed to support the work of the church. Mr. Armstrong said this is one reason why there were so many people in the church, comparatively speaking, compared to previous eras, which weren't as large and were largely scattered over the earth. But in this last day, these end times, well, you look at the size and scope of the worldwide church of God before he died. It's incredible. 120,000 members, 8.4 million subscribers to the Plain Truth, $170 million in income every year. And yet, like I said on Monday's program, even with all of this growth, even with this power, even with an amplified voice like what we saw in the 1980s, Mr. Armstrong perceived that the entire church was going to sleep. Even as Mystery of the Ages was first being distributed, the church surrounding that book, the church that had been supporting the message of that book for decades, the church was falling away from the truth, going to sleep, turning to darkness. That book from 1985, Mystery of the Ages, that book can bring you back into the light. That book can bring you back to the truth. That book can bring you back to support God's work. Mystery of the Ages. It was true in 1985. And it's true today. We're called to support the work and to be trained as teachers. The world's churches, they just focus strictly on the salvation part. And then there's this big contest, which means that a lot of people are being shut out of God's plan of redemption just because they don't know anything about it, just because they're living in ignorance. Ignorance has set in the traditional Christian world. That's the truth. Now, as Mr. Armstrong said early on in Mystery of the Ages, I'm not condemning or judging these people, and I presume they're as well-meaning as any people. God is not judging them now, as I shall explain later in this book. Neither is he condemning them. He loves them and will call them all. He'll call them all to eternal salvation in his own time. But as of right now, as of today, they do not know who or what God is. That's the truth. And you can prove it. You can prove the truth if you're willing to study God's word, if you're willing to dig into Mystery of the Ages, if you'll allow God to teach you, to educate you. If you're listening to this broadcast, chances are you're one who has a mind that's been opened to the truth. Or maybe it was years and years ago, but you've allowed the devil to close it. Mystery of the Ages can bring you back right with God. It's a wonderful book. It really and truly is, just like that that listener pointed out. It is the seminal literary masterpiece of our modern age. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email me some feedback, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.